Perfect. Thanks so much, Karen. Good evening. Thanks, Alvaro, for the invitation, for the wonderful introduction. It's a pleasure being here. It's lovely being here with you guys tonight. I don't often present or have conversation in a university, so it's fantastic. I'm really happy. Thanks so much again for inviting me. I'm also very excited about this project we have been doing now for the last 2 years on food sustainability. It's one of our, as Alvaro said, at the Economist Intelligence Unit, we do different. I mean, obviously, our core forecast, our core expertise is forecasting, economic and political forecasting. But we do lots of more kind of custom projects around these different topics. This is one of the most interesting, I think, also because it has to do really with us and with the sustainability of our planet. What Alvaro already mentioned, the incredible challenges that the food system are facing in the specific opportunities we have. If you look at the world population, it is increasing significantly. We are now at 7.6 billion. We're going to reach 8.1 billion by 2025. The bulk of the growth in population is going to be in developing countries. So obviously that's also creates another type of problems. All this population and the change in style of life and also nutritional patterns, which comes with, you know, people obviously having lots of population moving to cities, for instance, urbanization is part of the problem. You also have, you know, what we have been talking about, especially for Latin America, the emergence of the middle class in the past 10 years. This is obviously something very positive, but it's negative on if you look at it from the food sustainability point of view, because obviously it actually entails a change in nutritional patterns. So we're actually moving from a situation in which lots of the world population was diet was based more on cereals, on vegetables and fruit, to a situation whereby we consume more and more meat and more processed food. So there is actually a transaction in terms of nutritional patterns, which is going to actually put a lot of pressure on very limited resources. In terms of setting the scene and just show you a couple of quite scary, actually, piece of statistics when we talk about food sustainability and food. So those are what we call the food paradoxes, and three of them. First one is actually quite scary when you look at it. We actually waste every year something like one-third of the global food production. This is something, it's about 1.3 billion tons of food, which is wasted every year. If you look at countries like China, for instance, China is actually wasting every year what would be needed to feed about 200 million people, so one-sixth of their population. It's quite incredible what we're wasting, but also what is more incredible is that this corresponds to four times the amount which would be needed to feed the undernourished people in the world at the moment, 800 million people. The second challenge and paradox is around agriculture. So as we have seen, we're going to see more and more is this kind of pressure on the agricultural system in terms of production of food we need, but at the same time climate change as well, which is having its impact on agriculture. So what we are seeing is on one side agriculture is being reshaped by climate change, on the other side also producing, you know, agriculture in itself and producing food is going to have an impact, a negative impact on climate change in terms of emissions, in terms of ground pollution, and in terms of deforestation, obviously. So there's going to be this tension, which we are seeing and we're going to see more and more, between crop and food production. And also, what do we do? Are we actually producing food for human consumption? Are we using food for animal consumption, which at the end of the day is for human consumption as well because it's meat? Or are we producing actually food for biofuels, so for cars consumption? So we're going to have all this tension on a limited amount of resources we are left with. The third paradox in terms of food sustainability and food system is really what we are seeing, this coexistence between hunger and obesity. So just, again, another piece of statistic, over 2.1 billion people are obese in the world or overweight. And we, at the same time, on the other side of the equation, we have almost 800 million people who are undernourished. So we have two obese people for each undernourished people. Also, what we are seeing is that not only this is actually happening in the same country, whereby you have overweight, obesity, and underweight, and people who are not nourished to the right level, but you actually see it happening more and more in developing countries. So basically what you're seeing is that developing countries are kind of following a different pattern than the one we follow at the time when we were developing in terms of obesity. They're becoming obese much earlier in the stage. And this actually has a lot of implication in terms of sustainability of the health system, because obesity comes with a lot of problems, with a lot of non-communicable disease. Obesity is associated to 16 type of cancer. So it's really, you are faced, and in Latin America, you actually see it quite a lot. You're faced, the health system is faced with a double burden of communicable disease and non-communicable disease at the same time. So it's really quite dramatic for, especially when we think about the amount of resources available to those countries. In terms of the importance of sustainability in terms of being associated to end of poverty, as Alvaro mentioned already, 17 SDGs, 6 of the 17 are actually related in some form with food sustainability. So if you look, for instance, at SDG number 2, which is to end hunger and all forms of malnutrition by 2030, obviously this is the one which is the most linked. You have SDG 3, which is about ensure health and well-being for all at every stage of life. You have SDG number 10, which is reduce inequalities, also inequalities of access in terms of food. You have SDG 12, which is in terms of ensuring sustainable consumption and production patterns, so that's everything which has to do with sustainable agriculture and creating enough food for all of us. SDG number 13, which is take urgent action to combat climate change and its impact. As I said, agriculture is one of the culprits when it comes to climate change. And SDG 15, which is about protecting, restoring, and promoting sustainable use of terrestrial ecosystem. So it's quite interesting that really the food sustainability is very much at the center of the fight to end poverty by 2030, and the two teams are actually very, very related, and food sustainability is actually very relevant in that respect, because it's all, obviously we know the importance of people who are, you know, who have the necessary amount of nutrients and they have enough food to be able to be actually effective members of the community, and in terms of productivity is very important. So it's actually something which goes beyond, you know, eating the having enough food. It's actually which kind of food, and also it is about how do we make sure that we actually not waste food and we use the food that we would be wasting to actually give to people who don't have food. So in terms of our research, as I said, it's something that we started in 2016, and the idea was really about investigating the challenges that the global food system is facing. Okay, of course, it's very interesting from an academic point of view, but the idea was more to find a solution to that. And so try to use benchmarking, you know, comparing different countries on a number of indicators in order to be able to actually identify best practices. That's what indexes are for, right? It's not really the ranking. It's about how do we compare different countries and compare weaknesses and strengths and identify what are the best practices in each indicators. So that was actually what we were trying to do. The Food Sustainability Index, which we first launched last year in 2016, actually 2 years ago in 2016, is one of, I mean, there are other efforts, research efforts in the field, but this is really a quite compelling and rigorous framework to assess the sustainability of food system globally. We have been doing two iterations. So last we launched the last Food Sustainability Index in 2017, at the end of 2017, December. Also, the index is obviously the core of the research program, but it comes with a lot of research pieces. This year we did a very interesting white paper on the challenge for the Mediterranean system. I know you're more interested in Latin America, but that's actually an interesting white paper if you want to read it. We do a series of very relevant articles and blogs. You find actually everything on the link there on the URL. We also did a city monitor, which is again looking at 16 cities across the world and seeing how they perform in terms of different indicators relevant for food sustainability. So, for instance, indicators like the presence of green areas in the cities, their policy against food waste. So you can find all of these things. You will find on the hub, and also the rankings and there is an Excel spreadsheet there if you're interested in the specific ranking and if you want to use it for some of your academic work. So the index, as I said, is organized around three pillars. The three pillars comes from a combination of SDG and the Milan Protocol. The Milan Protocol is a protocol which was actually put together by organization of the civil society in Italy, among which the Barilla Foundation, and that was done ahead of the Milan Expo in 2015. So it was really about what the civil society and every interested stakeholder should do in order to address all these issues in food sustainability. And the Milan Protocol was then actually used was actually converted into a charter endorsed by the Italian government, which was presented as an outcome of the Expo in 2015. So the index includes 35 indicators and over 55 sub-indicators. And they all, you can look at them through different kind of themes. So there are economic indicators, environmental indicators, and societal indicators. Thank you. So just before we go, I mean, I'm not going to go through the indicators because I don't think it's really the. But you know, I'm happy to go over them if you have any question. As I said, everything is on the website. But before we look at really what are the main messages from the index, just define our definition of sustainability, because you need to have the same. Sometimes when we talk about sustainability, I guess each of us would have a different or very similar but different definition. So our definition is really the ability of a country food system to be maintained without depletion and exhaustion of natural resources or compromises to health and integrity, and without compromising the future generation access to food, which is very important, the sustainability over time. In terms of the framework, I just put some of the indicators. But what I like to highlight is that the index is composed by three pillars. Each pillar is composed by different sub-pillars. So if you look at the food loss and waste, this is composed by two sub-pillars, one looking at food loss and one looking at end-user waste. The sustainable agriculture is actually organized around three sub-pillars, which looks at water, land, and quality of air, so in terms of emission of greenhouse gases. The last element, which is nutritional challenges, which is all about this obesity, undernourishment paradox I mentioned, there we look at life quality, life expectancy, and dietary pattern. Also, as you see, as every index, obviously, when you build an index, the first thing you tend to do is looking at already available data. So there are a number of data which are actually coming from international organizations. But our, contribution, it's really the fact that we have the EIU it's part of our expertise. It's really to create indicators. So all these kind of especially policy response indicators you see, for instance, policy response to food waste, or a policy response to food loss. All those indicators are actually primary data. We have created them, and they're based on the expertise of our analysts. So again, it's a combination of secondary sources and primary sources. It's, as I said, the 35 indicators. We can go into details, but just for you to see, you know, like, for instance, we look at indicators when we look at food loss and waste. We look at kind of quantitative data such as food loss as a percentage of total food production. We look at indicators which are, as I say, more qualitative, like the policy response to food loss. We look at in sustainable agriculture, for instance, we look at water footprint. We look at the agricultural water withdrawals, which is a very important element in some countries. But also we look at biodiversity expenditure in research and development. We look at women in farming. We look at elements such as the presence of youth in farming, the average age of farmers. And nutritional challenges, we look at, obviously, indicators, again, quantitative in terms of, you know, rate of obesity or prevalence of overweight. We created also a very interesting indicators to assess the healthiness of the diet. We actually created an indicator based on use and percentage of people going to fast food. Which, again, you know, it was quite an interesting challenge, because in the beginning we were like, okay, are we just taking the usual suspect, the American chains, or do we also look at fast food, you know, the street food, Indian street food, Mexican street food? But then, can you really say it's not healthy? So it was quite a diplomatic effort, but we did create that. And I think it's I mean, obviously it's a proxy. It's never a perfect representation of what you want to measure, but it's, you know, it's an approximation of what you want to measure. So just in terms of additional refinement between the 2 years, what we did, so we published the first index, the first version of the index in December 2016. What we did in the course of the year is really go with this index to talk to experts, to talk to policymakers, and we convened a number of advisory boards to really look at, talk to people and say, okay, where did we get it right, where did we get it wrong, what can we improve, what can we do? I mean, at the same time, you know, you don't want to change it completely, because then you can only compare year from year. But we did do some adjustment in terms of number of indicators. Also, we added a number of background variables. We look, for instance, at healthcare spending, population growth, urbanization. We look at GDP per capita. We look at the Human Development Index. All these background indicators are quite interesting, because it's always very interesting to correlate them with the result of the index. So if you correlate all these indicators with the result of the, again, correlation is not causation. We all know that, but you know, it gives you some ideas. So, for instance, if you look at all these background indicators and you correlate them index scores, you see that in general, high, and it's not surprising, I'm telling you, but I think you can quite understand, it's very intuitive. So countries with high level of food sustainability normally tend to have higher income, high level of human development, smaller population, which is interesting because population is actually a challenge, and also a slower rate of urbanization. And it's all quite obvious, no? But it's still nice to see what, you know, when you see it on a graph. Also, we included nine new countries. So in the beginning, the original version of the index in 2016 was including the G20 plus a number of countries we had kind of handpicked just to adjust a little bit the geographical representation. So it was the G20 plus Colombia in Latin America, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and the United Arab Emirates and Israel in the Middle East and MENA region. What we did this year, as I said, we had this. We decided to have this focus on the Med, just because it's, you know, we are obviously in Europe, and you know, especially with the immigration crisis we had in the past few years, we thought it was quite interesting to focus on the Med, also because it's one of the region which encounters the most challenges in terms of climate change and food sustainability. So this year we added 9 new countries. So we added, most of them are from the Med. So we added Greece, we added Spain, we added Portugal, Morocco, Tunisia, Lebanon, Jordan. And we also added Sweden and Portugal. Portugal is kind of mad, but not. It's not really mad, but we tend to think of it as mad. So at the moment, we have a total of 34 countries. These represent 85% of the global GDP and 2/3 of the global population. We like to expand the coverage just because it's very relevant for, it's not a question of being, of covering 85% of global GDP, is really being able for this index to become a tool for countries to really see what needs to be done in each country. Latin America, at the moment, we include, unfortunately, just 4 countries. We include Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico. But still, you know, it's a good starting point. So key finding, I put there the findings. The first thing I would say is that if you look at even the first ranked one, which is France, so the score are actually 100 base scale. So you see that even France doesn't get a full score. So basically what this shows is that even the best ranked countries in the ranking are far away from being perfect in terms of food sustainability. What we have seen also in terms of when we look at all the countries and all the performances is that in general, countries which tend to perform quite well are the countries which have a very strong policy environment for food sustainability. And that's something which is probably true for everything, right? Because if you have a vision and you have a government which is actually focused on taking forward a specific agenda, is always there. I always say is the base. Obviously, you always need to involve the other stakeholder in a society, but when the government is leading, it's always quite good. So in terms of the common policy strengths, what we've seen is that the countries that are doing quite well in the index have policies to address food loss and also food waste. France, I will go into details about that later on, but France is actually the country which has the most holistic legislation in terms of food waste and loss. So Italy is also a very good one as well. And the majority of countries in the region are quite sensitive to the food loss and waste, just because of the amount of population. But if you look, for instance, at the bottom countries, the United Arab Emirates, and that's a problem with most of the Saudi Arabia as well. You know, the United Arab Emirates waste something like 1,000 kilogram per year per person, so it's huge. You know, and if you compare it to France, waste 100 kilogram. There's quite a difference. Then obviously the quality of policy, as I said, the policies and the quality of the policies is very important as well. Then in general, they have animal welfare policies in place. They have also, they're very worried about the working condition for the agricultural workers as well. And policy in place in terms of response to dietary patterns. So in terms of education, because obviously you always need to educate and also kind of direct behavior when it comes to dietary pattern. And then nutrition education, which is very important. Our countries in the region, Colombia is the best ranked, so it's number 13. Argentina comes at the middle of the table, and Brazil is the one which, in food sustainability, is the laggard in the region. In terms of going back to what I was saying, in terms of what is actually how also the best performance have some gaps. What you see here is that if you look at the best performance as well, they seem to have a number of challenges that they need to address anyway to maximize long-term food sustainability. Some of those challenges I've put in the diagram. So, for instance, environmental biodiversity is an issue for country in Europe. We have these indicators which look at the proportion of local breed classified as being at risk of extinction. So, in Germany, for instance, 74% of local breeds are actually classified as at risk of extinction. In Italy and Sweden, it's something around 51%. If you look, for instance, at diversity in terms of women and youth in farming, in countries like the UK or Germany, there are very few women in farming. So in the UK, there is 3% of workers in farming are women. This compares to countries like China or Nigeria. In China, 50% is women, so there's kind of a more even balance. But also youth, if you look at the average age of farmers in Europe, it's very high. Like if you see in Europe is late 50s, in Japan is the average age is 67. So there is an issue, obviously, because obviously you need to have young people also working in farming. But then again, you need to make it as an attractive option, right? So there are lots of issues around that. Another problem you'll see in most of the developed countries is really this problem in dietary patterns. So, as I was saying in the beginning, the more what a country progresses in the development stages, the more the diet tends to become based on meat. There's the sugar and salt consumption is quite high, and also lots of processed food. So, for instance, in Germany, 30% of the diet is sugar. And this compares 7% in the MED. So, as I said, you know, it's really a question of saying, okay, some countries are doing really, really well, but I think that's the beauty of an index. You can actually, in a way, dissect the different performance in the different indicators. So, again, why is it important to have, this index, but indices in general? Three things: best practices. So the indexes and the benchmark can showcase the countries that make strides towards, in this case, achieving sustainable food system. And also, it's really about highlighting policies, identifying policies and highlighting them as something for could be an inspiration for other countries. The second thing at the level of each country is really the area of weaknesses. So really looking at what are the gaps? What do we need to actually address to make sure that the overall performance is going up? And again, providing potential solution with the identification of best practices. And the last thing is really using the index as a way to track progress over time. So it's really about, okay, we do it every year. Every year we can see how a country has improved. And again, really use the index as a platform for debates on what needs to be done, on roadmaps to improve the situation in terms of food sustainability, and at the end of the day, in terms of really making sure that we are reaching the SDGs on time. So I'm just going to go more in details, just to offer some context, some ideas from the index in terms of the three areas. If we start with food loss and waste, so as I already mentioned, we know that obviously the number I mentioned at the beginning, 1/3 of all food produced go to waste. There are different modalities of food loss or waste. In the sense you have, depending on whether it's a country is developing or developed, is normally a different pattern. So it's for developed countries more food waste at the retailer and consumer level, and the food loss is more for developing countries. It's something which has to do with the pre-market or farm stage, and it's something due more with lack of good infrastructure to store for storage, for instance, or refrigeration, and also they are much more sensitive and much more vulnerable to drought and to natural shock. So these two different type of problems according to the type of country. But the thing which is actually common to both type of waste or loss is the fact that really it's not only we are kind of getting rid of food which we could use to waste to feed other people. And I know it's not so simple, because maybe where the food is lost, you don't have the people who actually need to eat. But, you know, in China, as I said, when you think that, you know, what is wasted could actually feed 200 million people, it's quite scary as a piece of statistic. And if you look at the US, for instance, 40% of food that is bought by consumers is then thrown to the bin. So it's 40%, it's half of it. Almost. If you think about also the carbon footprint, the implication for the environment of the food which is produced and not eaten, as I put there in my slide, this is actually the carbon footprint of food produced and not eaten accounts for something like 3.3 gigatons of greenhouse gas emissions, And also the water you're using to produce this food for nothing. So you're basically also wasting water in the effort. And the other thing is also food waste does actually create methane whenever it's thrown into a landfill. And the methane is a greenhouse gas, which is 21 times more damaging than CO2. So there's quite a lot of different issues in terms of wasting food. What we learn about that, what we learn from the index, and there again you have your ranking for those of you who are interested in the ranking. What we have learned in that respect is that luckily the issue is actually moving up in the political agenda globally. As I say, SDG 12.3 is about cutting food waste in half by 2030. The EU and the US have committed to do that. There has been also a coalition of the willing, NGO and 30 CEOs, and also policymaker that have they call the Champion 12.3, which actually are committed to make sure that we reach this target by 2030. But you know, it's something that you notice in general when you look at different countries. As I said, France is number one, and some of it has to do with the fact that it really has a vision, a holistic policy framework for eliminating food waste. So France has not only has actually appointed a minister for a ministerial position for agro food system in 2012, but in 2016 has passed a legislation which is truly holistic in how it looks at food waste. So it includes legal obligation for supermarkets to donate to excess food to charities. It's actually an obligation in France. It's not just a suggestion. There is a ban on expiration dates for certain categories of food, especially if you talk about wine or sweets or salt or vinegar. All those food, you know, they're not really dangerous. Even if you eat them, they may not taste very very nicely, but they are not dangerous to eat after the past date. So there is a ban on expiration date. There is also at the same time different levels. So how do we actually also educate the future generation? So education at the primary school level, and also tax incentive, because it's always good to kind of steer behavior in the right way. So this French legislation actually incentivize food donation also with tax incentive, and they do it not just for a processed good, but also for in the pre-process stage. So before, if a farmer would donate milk, he didn't have any tax incentive because the milk needed to be processed, and just the processor would get the incentive. Now both get incentive. So this is actually something that can be useful to direct behavior. Italy also scored highly in the index thanks to its low and incentivized food donation. But also what is important is also the awareness in general, not just in the civil society, but also from the business side. So you have lots of initiative from the civil society part. You have just to mention one, you have NGO in Portugal, Fruta Feia, who actually collect kind of fruits which is a bit blemished and repackage it, recycle it. You probably remember in at the Rio Olympics when there was this kitchen, this kind of soup kitchen in Lapa, which was set up by a Italian chef and other chef, and was actually they were actually cooking using the leftovers from the Olympic Village and feeding the hungry and the poor people in Lapa. So there are lots of things happening in the civil society, but also if you look at the majority of supermarket and retailer, they all have a program in place. Walmart has a policy to donate excess. Excess food to charity, or turn the food which is already expired into animal feed or compost, which is a very good way to recycle food. Asda has a program on beautiful on the inside, again about blemished fruit that people wouldn't necessarily buy. Sainsbury has a very similar program as well. So there is a lot of momentum, a lot of awareness in that respect. The other part of the equation is what I was saying, the loss at the farm, at the pre-market stage. That, again, is something that is probably more difficult to address in the sense that you really need to have to address the infrastructure problem. So you need to have good road and transport system, and you need to have good storage facility and, you know, refrigeration facility. It's more difficult, but then again, there are very, very lots of successful example. Like, for instance, in India, if you look at the fruit in India, about 25-50% of fruit is actually wasted because of the fact that there are no good refrigeration truck or refrigeration storage. Recently, they have launched a very basic kind of refrigerated truck, which is called City Fresh. And it's, you know, one-tenth of the cost of the truck, or the refrigerated truck in the US and Europe does the job. So, you know, there are ways in which you can actually address this kind of issue. In terms of sustainable agriculture, as I mentioned earlier on, this idea really of the nutrition transition, which most of the world is undergoing, it's connected to, as I said, rising population, especially in metropolis, in developing world, and you know, also linked to rising income for a bigger part of the population, which is good in a way, but you know, is a problem in terms of resources because they're limited. So in terms of two main problem in terms of food on the environment, one is the deforestation. So again, as I said, in the past, the livestock or meat was actually much, much lower in terms of proportion of the overall food diet in the world. Now, livestock account for something like 17% of calorie intake, but look at what it accounts in terms of land dedicated to animal feed. It's 80% of agricultural land in the world. Livestock also emit between 18% of the world's total greenhouse gases. In Brazil, for instance, pasture expansion to enable production of beef is now responsible for more than 3/4 of land deforestation in Brazil. So it's quite big. The other source of deforestation is palm oil and soybeans. As we know, palm oil is probably the most used oil in processed food. And it's a major problem. It's a major crop in Malaysia, Indonesia, and West Africa. And soybeans and beef are more drivers of deforestation in South America. The other aspect is the pressure on water. By 2030, the water demand from farmers is expected to increase by a lot, by 45%. And livestock again places more strain on water resources. Kilogram of beef takes 15,000 liters of water to produce. It's a particular problematic issue for countries which are quite arid. You know, as I mentioned, it's a big problem in countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. The agricultural sector use over 100% of their available renewable water resources. So those are actually very, very important problems. And in terms of what we learn in this. So two things. Obviously, it's the good thing is that if you look at how at growth in production in general, it doesn't really come. If you look at the last from 61 to 2005, you see that 77% of growth in production of food doesn't come from expansion of land, rather from increasing yield. So it's really about how do we increase the yield here. So obviously one of the answers is for countries who can afford that is really investing in new technology. So obviously precision agriculture, you know, the use of, we all know, very cool sensor, GPS, actually allow people to really tailor which part of the plant needs which specific fertilizer. So it's actually very good in terms of making sure that we are using the right amount of fertilizer, and we are also saving water. We know when to water a plant. So that's something very, very, very cool. Very, very, you know, for people who can afford it, it's really great. The other thing is the what we call vertical farming, which is the aeroponic agriculture, and it's really the idea of having this crop built in vertical beds, and you know, with with artificial sunlight, water, and soil. Everything is with sensors, so it's very easy. It's very cool. But on the other side, you know, for some countries, it's not you know, they don't have the resources. Developing countries, it's maybe more difficult to actually invest in this kind of new technologies. But there are solutions as well. Of course, institutional infrastructure reforms are very important. It's very important to give clear right on land, because obviously if there aren't clear land rights, there is no... Oh, God, I just have 5 minutes. I'm almost done. You know, there is no incentive to basically make investment to make the soil more fertile. But also traditional form of agroecological knowledge are very useful. If you look, for instance, what you see in Portugal or in some parts of Italy, this what they call the terracing. Terracing is actually very good because it's in a way it also reduces the soil erosion, but also is very efficient because it's, you know, the water is basically coming down, dripping down from each terrace. So it's something that I wouldn't say it's easy to do because it's a lot of work, but you know, something that could be done. The same, it's harvesting rainwater, which has been done for many years, is something that, you know, can help in saving water. But in general, apart from all this way to kind of increase the yield, it's true that there are going to be really careful choices ahead. We'll have to choose how we use the limited land. So is it, as I said, is it more for direct human food? Is it for non-food crops? Is it for biofoods? So that's actually one of the big questions. The last element in my last 5 minutes is... As I said, anger and malnourishment and obesity at the same time. I will just highlight a couple of interesting points, especially for developing countries. What we see in developing countries, as I said, it's really the fact that we see in the same country the presence of obesity and underweight. Not only sometimes within the country, but within the same individual, because you'll notice that in some cases when a child is stunted or is, you know, didn't have the micronutrient needed in the early 3 years of his life, it's much easier for this kid to develop obesity and diabetes. And that's because obviously if the fetus is created in a context in which there is very little micronutrients, the fetus becomes very adapted at it's needing very little. So whenever it's then confronted with a lot of fatty food and sugary and processed food, it will absorb this food much more and turn into obesity. So it's quite interesting because you see in the same individual, like stunted in the beginning and then becoming obese, or stunted obese at the same time. If you look at the case of Mexico, as we know, Mexico has a big problem with obesity. Mexico has the sad record of the highest obesity rates for women, about 35%. And in Mexico, if you look at kids up to five, it's quite interesting because 20 of them are stunted and 20% are obese. So it's kind of... And 1% is actually stunted and obese at the same time. So it is a problem. And the other thing which is a problem, and it's not as well known, is really the fact that even if the number of hungry people has dropped quite significantly in the last decades, there is still this problem of the micronutrient deficiencies. And this remains a challenge because it really leads to anemia. If you look at the statistic for anemia, for instance, you see that 2 billion people suffer from anemia in the world. This is about 30% of the population. So all these things have actually a very strong impact in terms of not only health and quality of life, but also in terms of productivity for the country at the end of the day. So all those issues can be addressed in different ways. Obviously, there is always the part of the education and awareness. So, like, how do we make sure that people are aware about, you know, the need to eat our five grains? We know here, but probably not in Mexico. How do we make sure that people really feed their children with the right food? So, it's a question of education and awareness, especially with mother. It's very good to do it at the material, you know, with women that are about to give birth, or you know, they're you know, with women in general, it's a very good investment. It also goes through, you know, all this program we see in Latin America, you know, like for kids, like making sure that they have healthy food at school and things like that. The other way is to use, to again, kind of drive behavior. So, you know, like what we have seen in Mexico, like the imposition of taxes on sugary drinks or processed food are also ways to, you know, direct behavior. But there's quite a lot going on. And really, I think the fact that we are seeing obesity increasing at earlier stages of the development cycle is a big issue, because, you know, it means that it is going to have a lot of impact in terms of sustainability of the healthcare system in those countries. So again, as I said, prevention, micronutrient deficiency, and the cities are actually very important, because cities are a big issue in the food system sustainability. It's, you know, when you move to when you have a high rate of urbanization, what you see, you completely change your pattern. But you do less physical exercise, just because, you know, there are no green areas, or it's quite dangerous maybe in a city to go out and play football. People don't eat anymore. It's not as easy to eat fruit and vegetables. It's easier to eat processed food. So there is actually peace around how do we make cities sustainable? How do we make sure, how do we plan cities to make it sustainable for us and for people? My last slide, am I still in the 5 minutes?
That's great.
Good, okay. So my last slides, I just did it for Latin America just to show you how the region perform with compared to France. So I'll put the overall ranking underneath for Latin America. You see that in general, the four countries' strongest pillar is the one on agriculture, sustainable agriculture. The least strong are really the food loss and waste and nutritional challenges. So Colombia is number, as I said, number 13, is the best ranked in the region. And it's actually scoring 4 in agriculture, so it's actually the best, it's among the top in terms of agriculture, and in particular thanks to its sustainable use of water and also the air quality. Land use is actually scoring, is actually ranked 27, so there is an issue in terms of land use, sustainable agriculture, and also how you use fertilizer and biodiversity. But overall, that's the main the main strength. In general, you will see that most countries in the region have a problem in what we call the life quality, which is life quality and life expectancy, which are looking at this kind of obesity and undernutrition in terms of micronutrients deficiency. For instance, are quite widespread in the region. Colombia is doing quite well, but the rest are not doing so well in micronutrients deficiencies. Argentina is doing quite well again, is number 9 in agriculture. Brazil is the only one within the sample, the very limited sample for Latin America, which is not doing as well in agriculture. It's ranked 28 in agriculture. And the main issue seems to be with land and sustainable agriculture. So again, the sample for Latin America is not very wide. But you're welcome to actually explore the different. You'll find in the website that you have. You can actually you have like country profiles, interactive ones. You can actually play and change compare the different indicators for different countries. And that's it. So that's again the website. So please use it. It's a tool for you. It's really something that we have done thinking about the students and how we can help.
Irene, thank you very much. I told you that it was really really good, and I'm sure we have lots of questions and. We're gonna use the last 30 minutes for that particular point to hear from you, to get your questions. But I want to take the chance to ask one question first, as the chair. As a researcher, one of the most important challenges that we have is the data. How reliable is the data that you're getting? Because I get the impression, especially coming from Latin America, that being Colombian, that's one of my nationalities. Sometimes our government gives us very magical realism numbers. So how reliable is the data in this report?
Well, I have to say it's very reliable. I mean, there have been challenges. Some of the challenges comes from the fact that some of the countries don't actually collect the specific data. I mean, you find very easily data more on, you know, obesity rates, these kind of things you find very easily. And they are, you know, you have international organizations who are collecting them. So normally when you go to international organization, you kind of trust them because, you know, they have already made them comparable across the different countries. It's what we were struggling a little bit was more in terms of really the impact, the policy, the vision. Is there a vision? Is there what are the measures? And to be honest, also the framework is quite challenging because, you know, as usual, when you do an index, it's like it's one representation of the reality, right? I'm sure that, you know, if you look at the index, why did you include this indicator? And it's for everything. It's like you can do 25 index on the same topic. So there is, it has been really challenging also because we have been engaging all these different people like academics, policymakers, FAO, all these organizations, and it is challenging sometimes because obviously everybody comes from a different perspective, and it's also such a complex topic. You know, there are so many different elements. So sometimes it was, first challenge was actually to come up with a framework which was made sense for the most the biggest number of people, and secondly, actually really going and look for the indicator which would actually be the most perfect possible. But that's, again, you know, like for instance, this indicator I mentioned before, the number of fast food per person, is not perfect. But again, what do you use to capture this kind of fishes? So you do something which is not perfect, but it's a good proxy. So I think the bottom line for me, it's like the index is not, I mean, of course, you want to make it as academic robust as possible, but it's more about, it's a tool, right?
Sure.
So it needs to really help people to focus action and attention on something. So I think in that sense we've been successful. Now, some of the indicators I think we could do, you know, we're still refining. But it is what it is. I mean, with indexes always, and you're right, I mean, especially when you look at countries across the, you know, with G20, majority of G20, you find indicators. Now we've done some of the MENA region, it's been quite challenging because some of the data simply don't exist. So you have to create them or go, you know, to the national source. It's what makes it fun, right?
And it's very interesting. And you can download the index in, I believe, downloads in Excel.
Yeah,
it allows you to play with the numbers and to use them. What I like to do now is give you the chance to ask questions. What I want to do is, if you could briefly identify yourself and just be very brief to the point with the question. I'm going to take three questions at a time, and then we'll come to the second round. So I'm going to start with you in the back. Can you speak very...
Yes, Julian Turner, Tavistock. My question, you focused about the need to reduce consumption, which is increasing. How can we challenge those trends of a growing middle class that may be attracted to aspirational diets of eating Western meat in China and Brazil and places? And how can we counter maybe the forces of large multinationals like Brazil, who has the biggest meat processing company, JBS, for example? And how can welfare standards be improved, say in the Middle East, which is notorious for poor treatment of animals, such as CCTV and such as in France, and reducing labor exports.
Thank you very much. Very good, very good, comprehensive question, Stuart. Yes?
Hi, I'm Ginny Firth. I'm a PhD here in human geography, and I work on food. Really enjoyed your talk. I was curious how you ended up measuring fast food and street food. So would you speak a little bit about that diplomatic process that you described it? And then what were those conversations like and with whom? It's reminding me of debates that are happening in some of the contexts I'm working in, so I would love to hear what that conversation was, what the dates were.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Jenny. I'm here, and I'll go to the rest in the second round, please.
Hi, I'm a student at the MSc for Environmental Policy and Regulation.
And your name is?
My name is Jaspreet.
That's good.
Thank you for your talk. My question is to do with the use of pesticides and fertilizers in developing countries, because in terms of sustainable agriculture, there is an excessive use of pesticides and fertilizers. So has that been accounted for in any part of the index? And do you... you know, given that excessive use decreases the quality of land, do you think that it would be important to
consider? Thank you very much. I think we're going to start with these three questions.
Yeah, sure. No, they're all great. Meat consumption. I mean, I see your point in the sense that it's... Then again, you know, you look at countries like Brazil or Argentina, those countries have been... I mean, they're a bit different from the rest, I guess, from most of the developing countries, because they have a very traditional diet based on meat, right? So it's more about how do you change that? How do you change the pattern? I mean, I think it's more. I mean, it's not a question of saying, you know, obviously, who has an interest in selling meat. Of course, there are people having an interest in selling meat. And, you know, as I said, you know, it's if it's part of your diet and it's obviously all, I mean, I don't eat much meat, but, it's meat.
Speak of Argentina.
Yeah, speak of Argentina. Speaking of Colombians, I mean, you know, but I think it's more really when you look at the balanced diet, I guess it's really about making sure that you get from the diet all. I mean, if you look from the point of view of the diet, it's really okay. You need to get all the necessary element which makes for a healthy diet. So I guess it's again a question of balance it in the best way possible. But it's more when you look at the environment, no? Because some of the data I was showing are really quite striking in the sense that if you think how much water used to produce a kilogram of meat, what is the, you know, the implication in terms of emissions, and just in terms of what, as I said, you know, we are going to be more and more faced with choices, because basically the land is limited, the amount of land is limited, the population is growing. You can, of course, increase yield, but then again, we come to your problem. Sometimes to increase yield, you're actually depleting the soil. So it's really how do you do it? And at some point, it's like saying, okay, we need to find a solution. And the solution is really making sure part of the solution will be to consume less meat and to produce less meat, because it's the only way to make sure that it's sustainable. And I guess there are obviously business interests. But I would think, you know, it's the same in a way what happened with the food waste and loss, you know. For supermarket in general, if you think about it, it's actually better to have people buy lots of food and then they don't really care whether they waste it or not. But at the same time, you know, there has been this, there is now this awareness, and it also from supermarkets, it's really this they have joined the crusade in a way in reducing food waste and loss. So I was thinking for meat, maybe it's something that's going to happen. It's happening already. So it's really about what is the reality. We cannot really, we have really to, we are facing a crisis in a way, because we, you know, there is a limited number of resources, and we need to make sure that these resources are enough for all of us and for the future generations. So we'll have to do something, and I guess it will, hopefully, it will happen for meat as well. And again, education awareness is come from us as well, right? It's really what we think. It's not just what we see the marketing and what the business sector does or what the government does. It's really us. So that's why I think those type of efforts are good, because they're actually for all of us. It's not just, I mean, our we're doing it, and what we're doing it, because obviously the website is constantly updated. We think about policy maker, but we also think about, you know, civil society and all of us. So I think it's again a matter of altogether looking, highlighting, and this is actually useful to highlight what are the challenges, and for meat processors as well. So the fast food
diplomacy.
It was more internal diplomacy, because in a way we were like, okay, what are we going to use here? I'm like, first of all, we called it, I think the original name was unhealthy food or something like that. I was like, we cannot really call it unhealthy food, because, you know, it's, so let's call it fast food, like neutral way. And then it was the other question, fast food is very different according to the culture. In some cases, it's not unhealthy, you know, it's... So at the end, we actually just look at them, also because it was easier when you had to collect data for 34 countries. So we just took the the five big biggest chain in the US. But even there, you know, it's sometimes I feel that, you know, it's we don't actually name names, but it's kind of obvious what we are including there. And as I said, it's not a perfect indicator because, again, you know, it's maybe a bit unfair for some of those chains because, you know, they have been doing quite a lot in terms of becoming more health conscious. But yeah, I think we wanted to have some real kind of insight into the issue. And this is not perfect, but it's something that, you know, if you look at with, if you put together with other indicators, looking more at, you know, quantitative data, it gives you a rough idea of what is going on. Yes, I mean that's a concern. We actually are looking at a number of indicators in the index in the sustainable agricultural category in terms of, as I said, biodiversity and also all in terms of use of fertilizer and depletion of the soil. It is a concern. I mean, obviously, it's a big concern because it's really about how do we keep the land we have for future generation. As I said, you know, new technologies are actually very helpful in that respect because obviously if you can use sensors, if you can actually monitor constantly what type of fertilizer is needed and what type of water is needed is ideal, right? Because you actually give the plant the right amount of everything. And even, you know, drones, now it's like drones are used to monitor deforestation in Brazil and it's amazing, you know, that what technology can do. I guess the problem is making sure that people have access to that, and I guess it's in some cases. I'm sure that also with time, those innovation will be cheaper. I think there is a very important piece, as I was mentioning, in terms of for developing countries, especially looking at the traditional wisdom on and, you know, traditional agricultural techniques, which, you know, in some cases can help. Like, as I said, all this, you know, I was in Portugal recently, and it's amazing. You see this beautiful terrace and you think that, okay, it's a lot of work, but then again, it's just so smart, the way in which the water is dripping down the different terraces. And now it actually helps also soil erosion. So there are ways, and I guess it's also not just looking, going. Sometimes we have the tendency to just go for the high-tech option without looking at the traditions, but sometimes the tradition is actually a solution, at least in the interim. Mm. But yeah, it's a big question. I mean, that's...
Thank you so much, Erin. I'm going to go with the second round, and I know that there was someone there. Go ahead first.
Okay, thank you. My name is Carla Mora. I am a student in the Social Policy Master Program. I'm writing my dissertation in food security.
Oh, fantastic.
My question is how countries could use this index to maybe design monitoring or even evaluating policies in terms of food security? How can they complement their analysis using this special
source? Thank you very much, Carla. Great question. Here in the front.
I'm Eduardo. I'm doing a master's in environmental development here too. And it's funny because you put a lot of emphasis on technology and innovation. And for example, like when it comes to agrochemical companies like Monsanto, like where do you place? In the big picture, the role of genetically modified food, and for example, like this company is focusing now more on or starting to focus on micronutrients rather than more resistant or like drought resistant grains or, you know, this kind of thing.
Thank you, Jory. And I'm gonna take one more.
Hi, I'm Daniela. I'm doing a master's in environment sustainability at Birkbeck University. My question was your thoughts on the impacts of the growing superfood trend that's kind of coming alongside sort of vegan diets and health food diets, and kind of your thought on the social and environmental impacts of that, because obviously it's great in terms of less meat consumption and better nutrients, but obviously it's also coming from afar and there's a lot of social problems with that, the importance of that, and a lot of stuff we don't know about in terms of like coconut production and goji berries and all those lovely superfoods that we're all using, but it's not necessarily good for people producing them.
You realize you're going to be quoted in many theses in the future.
Oh dear,
here.
Not. Okay, starting with Carla. So I think this index and indexes in general, their main reason of being, it's ready to be a tool for policymakers, I think, you know, in a way. So in different ways. One, I would say it's really looking at that, because the index you always have a rank, which actually is what compares you to the rest of the world, and a score, which is actually the measure of your performance. So you can use both in the sense that the score is something that you can use to monitor your performance against yourself over time, you know? Because you can improve or not improve with respect to the score. The ranking, sometimes you can improve in the ranking just because other countries are moving as well. So the score is actually important to monitor your absolute performance. And the ranking is something that for me I would use, and I work a lot on indexes in my life, and it's really about how you compare your countries. You obviously there is the ranking, the global ranking, the top ranking, which is what you use to attract the attention of media and policymakers as well. But then how do you go from the big number to the different numbers under? So it's like really looking at what is your performance in all the different elements, and then compare. And then again, you know, indexes like this one, you put countries are very different together, so it's very difficult to compare kind of apple and pears. But then again, you can always compare yourself. Say you're Brazilian, so maybe you can compare yourself with countries which are in a different, in a similar stage of development and have similar challenges in terms of population or, you know, size. So it's really about, okay, let's look where are my areas of weaknesses, where are my strengths? And if I look at weaknesses, how do I actually learn from the other countries similar to me, which have a better score? So that you used to actually go and see what they have done. Maybe they have adopted a particular law, maybe they have a particular use of whatever, of specific technology or... You know, it's really the way in which you use index as a tool. So, and to your point about how they can complement it with national sources, I think it's actually the best use of index, because in a way, index is always, by nature, is very generic, right? Because when you compare 35 countries, you cannot actually have the level of details for the specific indicators. But you can do it at the national level. So it's just, you can almost take the framework of the index and kind of find specific indicator, more specific and more tailored for the countries. You can do it at city level as well, right? You can take the same ideas and do it at the city level. We did try to do it last year. It's not even an index. It's just, we call it a monitor because it's just a collection of kind of food sustainability indicators at the city level. But I think the city, as I said, we need to have city level data also, because it's, if you look at it, it's really where the biggest problem are at the moment in terms of sustainability, and it's really about what is the vision for city. I mean, when you go to Mexico City, for instance, I remember like years ago when they were among the first, you would go to a restaurant, there was no salt. And I'm like, what's your problem? Where is the salt? But it was actually a policy not to give salt, not to have salt available, so you had to ask for it. So maybe you would think before putting salt. So it's there is a lot happening at the urban level, which is really important and really interesting. So yeah, I mean, I think the two should complement, and I think that the policymaker should use it as a tool, as one of the tools they use. And again, it's really about creating a platform which is quite neutral for a conversation and for improving. The index won't give you the solution, but it will actually give you a neutral base of discussion and comparative base of discussion, and hopefully help in kind of putting together a designing roadmap towards improvement. So that's the main I think... contribution of an index. And Eduardo, you had one on the Monsanto and micronutrients. I'm not an expert on any of these things. I don't think I have made up my mind in terms of genetically modified food. I was at an event, was the conference recently on food sustainability, and there was this lady who has been working on genetically modified food. And, you know, the picture she was painting was amazing. I was just like, actually, she's right. You know, she made sense. She was talking about how it done in the right way, it can actually help, like in terms of obviously creating new... and also in terms of, and she was also saying that most of the food are actually genetically modified somehow, because she was mentioning some, I think papayas in, I can't remember who it was, I think in Jamaica or somewhere, that they actually have genetically modified them because there was some kind of problem in Jamaica. I don't remember if it was one of those countries. I think it was Jamaica. Jamaica. So they had the problem. They had to actually modify it because nobody could actually eat papayas. But again, I don't know. I don't know enough. I'm not an expert. I don't really know enough whether it's good or bad. I think again, it's we probably need to have more. I think in Europe, what we get is probably very different. Press for genetically modified food as opposed to the US. I guess in the US there's more tolerance. Here we're a bit culturally, we're actually. We'll see what your dissertation will say, but please let me know when you have. I wouldn't be comfortable to say because I don't really, I actually haven't made up my mind. I change my mind every day when I talk to people who knows more than me. And I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I'm like, but actually, maybe not. Yeah. So the jury is out. We still need to find the solution. And Daniela, the vegan side, the superfood. You're right. I think it is an issue with not just with superfood. I think in general, it's really about the sustainability of the supply chain, right? Because sometimes you don't really know. You know, it's something that looks very healthy, but you don't really know how it is produced. So, what are the different? And I guess that's another question. And it's what we did actually another study we did actually a very interesting study, which I can give you the link to sustainability of supply chain. So we actually look at how do you make sure as a company that your supply chain is sustainable, and it is a big challenge because basically sometimes there are so many little producers involved in a supply chain that it's very hard to keep track. I guess something that maybe blockchain could help, like in terms of, you know, of making sure that we certified all the different producers. But I think it's a big question. It's going to become, especially also because people are now much more aware of these issues. No? We are all much more... we actually value much more than before, probably the sustainability of the supply chain and where the food comes from, whether we are actually exploiting anyone to create it. So I guess there is increasing awareness and there is increasing effort made also from companies to make sure that they certify somehow their supply chain. But it's a big. I wouldn't say just for superfood. It's really for everything and food in particular. So. It's another big question.
We have time for another round of questions, so please.
Hi, I'm Lucy. I study development management here at LSE as a master's. Just in terms of the kind of econometrics of your research, I wondered why just 34 countries, why those in particular? What about emitted variable bias or kind of exogenous events which could have inflicted the results? And considering there's only 34 countries, what if you found new research which suggests that actually France wasn't the best, that it's the highest, and what about other countries? I don't understand how 34 countries mm-hmm. can be of any use for anything, considering there's 200 plus countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, it's a very good question.
Luis, any more? Yes?
I'm Marilyn. I'm doing a master's in environmental policy. So I was wondering if coffee is a part of this indicator because it's the second most trade commodity next to oil. And if you have anything to comment on like the rise of direct trade, so beyond fair trade standards and organic where there's a complete lack of a middleman and instead the producers actually supply directly from suppliers that are also sometimes even processing on-site.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the third one I'm going to put forward myself.
Oh, perfect.
How do you decide on a country in a way similar to what you were arguing? And what countries are you planning to include next?
So, again, countries, the thing is that those indexes are actually quite expensive to do in the sense that obviously it's a lot of work in terms of collecting data. So, what you normally tend to start quite small in this kind of things, unless you have lots of money. Again, we looked at beginning. We look at the idea was to do the G20, which could be obviously it's 20, but it actually is quite representative in terms of, as I said, GDP, and it's 85% of global GDP and two-thirds of population. And then we added a couple of countries which just to kind of complete a little bit the regional representation. So we had Colombia, for instance, since Latin America was a bit underrepresented. We had Ethiopia and Nigeria and Africa just to make it even more representative. This year, what we did is that we wanted to focus very much on the Med, on the Mediterranean. So we added all the Mediterranean countries. It's not, I mean, again, ideally, you're right. Ideally, you would want to have 150 countries to have to compare. Index, again, it's really about comparing best. At the end of the day, it's really about comparing best practices and making sure that you are actually. I would say the first thing is really the framework, making sure that you think that the framework makes sense in terms of methodologically, like you are actually looking at the right indicators. And then that you can actually apply to all the countries you want. You know, it's like you can do it for 50 countries, you can do it for 150 countries. The thing I still think it's relevant to do it for 25 countries, for 35 countries, because in any case, what you're saying, you're not saying that actually France is the best in the world. For France to be the best in the world, you should have 100 over 100, right? Because we are scoring those countries on 0 to 100. So if one country didn't have any problem at all, would have 100. It's not the case of France. France has a score of 70-something. So, again, it's really about making sure you have the framework in place. Then obviously it's not a perfect framework, and you're refined. Then you have your. I think 35 countries actually is pretty good.
It's
pretty good number. I mean, I've seen index stand for 6 or 7 countries, which I agree with you. 6, 7 countries. I'm not sure what's the relevance. Here is pretty representative in the sense that you have countries around the world. You have country, you know, a geographical representation. In terms of next steps, obviously we'll try to include more and more. We haven't actually looked at what we will be doing next year. I think it's also related to which region we want to focus on. So I guess we'll Latin America definitely we need more because we have very very few, and it's a big question. You know, it's one of the big issues there. But equally, Africa we should have more. Yeah. I think. We haven't discussed yet what to. We depend as well on how much money we have, to be honest, because it's really the and data availability. Because sometimes you know you start with a list of countries, but then you don't have enough data.
Yes.
So it's always a bit of a. I mean, indexes, to be honest, is always I always say it's not really. I mean, you tend to make them as academic as you can, but then again, it's more about. They're a tool, right? They're not perfect. They're a tool. They're a vision of the representation of the reality together with many others. You can agree, you cannot agree. But I think as long as it helps to actually focus the conversation on something and to create a dialogue on the issues, then you can argue about one indicator not being perfect, or maybe you would have used another one, or maybe the weight as well. Weighting is another issue, right, when you do an index. In this case, what we did, it's for this index, there is weighting. Last year, we had three different weightings. So we had a neutral weighting. We were giving the same weight to every indicators. We had a policy-based rating. So we were giving more weight to the policy-related indicators. And we had another one, which I cannot remember. This year, I mean, my personal preference, when I do index, I always prefer to have it neutral weighting because it's like, it's always so controversial, unless you have a very strong kind of literature or, you know, academic underpinning to say, okay, this indicator should be, you know, more important than these other indicators. And sometimes it's also a question of, if you look at the stage of development, maybe some elements are more important in a stage of development rather than a different, or size, you know, there are so many different aspects. But this year we actually went for expert-based weighting. So basically we had a panel of people. We asked them to weight the index that we get. But at the same time, when you go to the website, you have the different weighting. So you can put whatever weighting you want. And I think it's also quite useful because if you're a policymaker, for instance, it's more relevant to have a index weighted on the policy indicators because that's what is really changing. That's what you want to impact on. And the last question.
What about coffee?
What about coffee? Yeah, that's a very good question. We don't really look at coffee per se in the index. We do have an indicator on the concentration of crops because that's one of the problems in many countries, in Latin America in particular. You have really the crops concentrated in 2 or 3 crops. So we don't look at coffee per se in here. It's maybe something we could look at in a article, because we are and actually I'm going to note it down. We always, as I said, the program, it's kind of an ongoing program. So basically, we always try to complement the general information of the index with very interesting. And I think the coffee value chain and innovation in that is something really interesting. What's your view on that? I mean, I
worked actually in a specialty coffee shop for a little bit, so I got really into the difference between just like mass-produced coffee and not just the quality behind specialty coffee, but also the way that the commodity is traded beyond these labels like fair trade and organic, using this label like direct trade, where these actual small coffee shops go and make partnerships with farms and then source directly from them. And basically that almost checks all these boxes of ensuring better prices for the farmers, better standard for the workers.
Yeah.
So all around it's like, it's a small, I see it as like a
it's
cool,
growing,
small,
right? There is a lot,
And like this the hype, I would say, is increasing for specialty coffee. Mm. And I just think, relatively though, it's probably very, very, very small.
It's
the second largest traded commodity.
But it is increasing. I mean, you should tell us, Alvaro, you're a Colombian after all. You should tell us.
Colombian. And if my career fails as an academic, I'm also trained, certified barista, so I suppose I can always find a place somewhere else besides the LSE. Very good question.
It's
you might actually
question.
See that included
yeah,
in the future.
I'm going to, yeah.
You have to give him
question.
Credit for that.
Yeah, I will send it to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to end this brilliant lecture. I'm very, very delighted. As I told you at the very beginning, I wasn't lying to you. You live with a smile on your face after today's lecture, and I think that's the case. I am living with a smile on my face. But I want to use this opportunity to thank Irene for her presence here. It's been a pleasure to have you, Irene. Thank you so much for your visit.
Thank you. Thank you.
If everything goes well, you'll have a podcast for those of you who are doing research to slowly listen to every single detail. So thank you so much.
Thanks.
We have an event on Thursday as well, which is about integration in Latin America, the Pacific Alliance countries. So you can find information on the website.
I'm going to be there. Yeah.
Irene, estuvo fabuloso. Estuvo muy bueno. Las preguntas buenísimas, ¿sabes?
Sí.
Una foto ahí.
Por una vez.
Mira, mira.
He's my coffee supplier. Every time he goes, he brings me back some back. Well, who knows? It's all the stuff that gets swept up.
I do have an email. Just because we don't really have access to it.